Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
He's unpredictable. He's relentless. He's fearless. He's smart. He's a jerk. Oh, man, what a jerk. How would you describe Kirk Minahan?
He's talented.
He's blunt.
He's complicated.
He's the fakest tough guy I know.
He's honest.
A self-proclaimed weenie.
He's angry.
He's actually a good guy.
He's a psycho big-mouth prick.
I wish we had more Kirk Minahans.
How would you describe Kirk Minahan?
Combustible.
Unpredictable.
Venomous.
Testy.
Obnoxious.
Selfish.
Polarizing.
Pompous.
Enough about me. Let's get to the show.
It's Kirk Minahan's Enough About Me.
It's almost embarrassing if I have to describe Bob Ryan to anyone listening right now. He is the legendary columnist of the Boston Globe, the legendary beat writer for the Boston Celtics. I grew up during the Larry Bird years, and I've got the chance to work with him on radio and TV, where he's gotten a little bit of trouble, and he's getting some more trouble recently with ESPN. He called Mark Jackson a Bible-thumping phony and got a two-week suspension for it.
It was a very stupid. I mean, I'm so angry with my own self. I was treated exceptionally well by ESPN, and so I just want this to go away.
Do you think? Look, I'll just ask you this: if Mark Jackson was still an NBA coach or worked for CBS or Fox Sports, you don't think he would have been suspended, though?
Absolutely not.
Right.
No, it was all about a Lodge brother thing.
Right.
And it was dumb. You know, they couldn't allow me to. I'm talking about it.
Well, they couldn't allow me.
And I wouldn't, if I were them, it would be the same thing. I totally understood their point of view. They couldn't allow me to denigrate a Lodge brother. That's all. If you worked for Fox, nothing would have happened.
I guess what's different for us is, at least in the business that I do, you know, I dump on people all day I work with. I mean, that's kind of part of the business.
It's not part of the, and that's not the way in the world of Disney.
Yeah, the world has changed.
Well, that's fine.
Do you think that the Globe treated you fairly 14 years ago?
Oh, now that one I love to talk about. No. And I think...
Because I
deserved like 2 weeks, perhaps.
And how long did you get?
Nothing to do with the Globe. But, you know, I thought the month was really harsh. It was exceptional.
Jesus, that's a long
suspension.
And
it wouldn't allow me to do anything. And I didn't fight it. I didn't go, you know, I didn't go to the union and file a grievance. Some of the people might have. Because did they have a right to prevent me from not only working for them, which is their right, but for doing anything.
So you can do ESPN. You can do sports reporters?
No, nothing. No TV, no radio, no speaking. No public activity, nothing.
Well, how
I was grounded for a month.
How does that work?
It worked. I just went along with the program.
You just said, fuck it, I'm not going to.
I just, I sat out a month. I mean, and it just so happened, as luck would have it, it was a month in which I did have some speaking engagements, which I did have. I figured out it cost me about $23,000.
Jesus Christ.
And I figured it was 2 weeks for the Globe and 2 weeks for what was then West 43rd Street, was then the headquarters
right,
of the Times.
Right.
And remember, the Times owned the Globe, and he had just purchased the Globe about a year ago. Marty Baron. The star of Spotlight.
Big hero.
Was, right. And who deserves to be the hero of Spotlight.
Sure.
He was impressing the bosses, I think, a little bit with that. And it took me a long time for that to kind of blow away. Every once in a while, people make reference to that. Now, of course, the irony of the whole thing, of course, with your minor kid is she and Jason eventually did get divorced.
Right.
Jason probably did get sick of her and vice versa.
This is where I get in trouble sometimes, is my defense will be, you know, nobody thought that you were actually advocating for
it. Was
this
hyperbole.
But that's what I mean.
It was strict, utter hyperbole. And the problem with that one was that I had forgotten or not taken into account that
the
she
prior
had
history,
been hit.
Right.
She had been hit by Jamana Kidd. That seemed to exacerbate.
By Jason Kidd, yeah.
Jason Kidd. That seemed to have exacerbated that situation. Obviously, no reasonable, rational person on earth thinks I was serious.
If it's me, and sometimes I get crazy. There's part of me at that point that might just say, because you're a desired guy at that point, that's 02?
I was 03.
03. There's part of you that could have said, you know what? After the month suspension, you could have said, screw you, I'm leaving, I'm going to ESPN, I'm going somewhere else, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Was there ever a temptation? Did you come close to doing it?
Not a temptation, but do you know who actually called me up You know, and among the many people who caught up in, you know, in offering support and
right.
I won't say sympathy, you know, but empathy,
yeah.
And was kind of giving me a pep talk and even offered to set up a discussion with his boss about possibility of
Donald Trump.
Jerry Callahan.
Right. Yes, I believe that. I believe that that's true. He wrote about it.
Jerry Callahan did indeed. I can remember exactly where I was. I was visiting. We were spending a weekend in Moultonboro, New Hampshire. So anyway, but I didn't. No, I liked my position at the Globe, and I just wanted to get back and get going. And you know. So no, I did not give it serious consideration. And of course now, and as the time went on, I got along fine with Marty Baron, and everything's fine. You know, I didn't hold a grudge or anything like that. I just wanted to get. You know, get back in where I was. Just get back to my job.
Over the years with the Globe, was your contract year to year? Was it
no contract. I was a union member.
Oh, right.
So we were with the Guild. You know, the Globe Union.
Right.
I had no contract. I never had a contract. It was always a...
So you could have walked in any time?
I was a member. Sure. I was a member of the union. That was it. I had no contract issues. Oh, yeah. If I ever wanted to walk, I could have walked, yeah. I did in 82.
Right.
I went to Channel 5. And that was a very interesting chapter in my life because I answered the question. The answer to the question of is just how you want to spend the rest of your career. Is
so you were a Celtics beat writer at the time.
That time, I had gotten off. I had just gotten off for the second time after 82. I was kind of not washed out, you know, but I've had enough at that moment. And I was going to become a feature writer, and I was going to get a chance, you know, NBA at large, but not the Celtics. And I remember talking Dan Shaughnessy. I mean, bringing him down to my house for dinner and everything. You know, you got to be the guy. I want you to take this job, which he did, because you know his baseball wasn't his first love. Mm-hmm. Basketball, very definitely his second love, but it's a distant second.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Fine. But he did take that job. So, and then in the interim, you know, we had that story was all about. Ray Fitzgerald, the great Fitzgerald, had died, and it was a columnist vacancy, and I always assumed, and with good reason, believe me, that I would be the next official columnist, led to believe that by the people at the Globe, and they didn't give it to me. They gave it to Mike Madden. Now, I had nothing against Mike Madden personally. We're friends, and fine, but I thought I was deserved that job.
So you think you get screwed over, so Channel 5 calls.
So I was vulnerable. Right. Clark Booth walks up to me at Ray Fitz's funeral, by the way, he was leaving his position as this with the sports job at Channel 5 to go to do, you know, other stuff, news and stuff. And he thought I'd be great for his job and told me to really consider going to work at Channel 5. Well, I was a little susceptible to the flattery, and I was also feeling sorry for myself about what was going on at the Globe. And so he hit me at just exactly the right time. And I said, yeah, you know, I had been at the Globe 14 years. And, you know, and it was enticing. It was, and I did. So I went.
What did you do at Channel 5?
What I did was a job that no longer exists, but basically because they don't have any time. But in those days, this is the golden age of local television, where the nightly sportscast had about 6 to 7 minutes, and the weekends had 9 to 12.
Right.
And so somebody could come in as a reporter and do a daily piece, 5 days a week, either by covering a game and doing what they call a package.
No.
I'd cover a package, or go interview somebody and set up a little scenario, a little story, a little human interest, whatever it is. And then they also gave me a thing we called it the Ryan Report, with a nice little logo with a notebook, and it was basically a notes column on the air.
Right.
You know. And
did you find this satisfying?
No. And that's why I left, because the overarching reason is that unlike print journalism, it's a completely collaborative medium. You need a story. You need a boss to help you get an idea. You need a story editor to approve it. You get a camera person to coordinate his or her time with the interview subject, and that can get dicey sometimes. Then after you do the interview, you come back, you screen your tape, and you write down where the sound bites are that you might want to use, and you write your copy. Then you have to get into the edit room. You plot, you know, you get a time given to you in the edit room. Well, sometimes people run over the time before you, and now instead of having an hour or an hour and a half, you have 40 minutes or four, and you're not doing the job you want to do. Also, all editors aren't created equal.
Correct.
Some are better than others.
Right.
And I didn't, you know, and so all this added up to that maybe 2 out of 5 days a week, I liked what I got.
Right.
I really like, and that's not good enough. And that's A. B, plus the lifestyle was different, completely different. Travel was different. Everything was different. And the most amusing part was that you got paid overtime to go to the game. You got paid. Your salary was based on an 8-day workday. And if you went to cover the game at night, which is a Celtic game or a Bruins game,
they pay you for 4 hours.
You got paid.
Hours?
You got overtime. I thought that was great, but I thought that was stupid.
How long did you last there?
1 year and 2 months before I decided, after having a conversation, I have to back up. There's a connecting thing. I was going
I have no memory of this.
I was going about 2 months. This is September of 82 I left.
Oh, I was young, but okay.
About 2 months later, I got a call from Vince Doria, the fourth editor of the Globe, my boss. And he said, you think you could do two columns a week for us on the side? I said, no, that's a job, but I could do one. One week and work out one.
Right.
And so basically for the next 17 months, I went in basically every Monday morning right away and wrote a column on anything, you know, and then I went over to Channel 5.
Did you find yourself looking forward to the writing part?
Oh, positively. I love being – so I can truthfully say I have never left the Globe and that I've been in there for the best – you know, continually since 1968.
So you must have had legit offers over – I'm going to guess the National
– Very few.
Sports Illustrated.
Very
That's
few.
Not true.
True.
Is that true?
Very true.
What's the big – what's the offer? Forget that you went to Channel 5. What's the writing offer that you got over the years? And I know you got one or two that you said, I think there's a good chance I'm going to take this.
Never.
Never.
The closest one was in Los Angeles Times since 1976, was talking about baseball. And the way they wanted to do baseball was a wall-to-wall spring training to the end of the World Series with, you know, very little time off. I knew that wasn't going to fly.
Man, baseball beat writer to me seems like a shitty beat.
Well,
though.
But
I know.
Yes. Oh, now
I know
it's
you
worse.
Love baseball.
Oh, now
but...
it's worse than ever. Wait, oh, now I couldn't imagine any beats in any sport, but baseball least of all. Oh, positively.
Right, the truth.
You got it. I mean, it's a killer.
Well, I think about, you know, I'm real good friends with a guy like Bradford. I mean, he's got to get there 4 hours before the game. You stand
four.
There. 5, 6. You got to stand there like an idiot in the locker room.
You're
the
late.
Players give you nothing.
You're late if you're 4 hours.
And you're right. Between the life of the game, you are tweeting 70 times. You're posting 5 or 6 blogs, post game blogs.
None of this,
write a column.
None of this existed at the time. It was simply a matter of the.
Right.
So, look, here's my. I'll give you a total summation.
Go ahead.
The end of my first year covering the Celtics in 1969-70, I got a call. Bill Tanton, of the sports editor of the Baltimore Sun, wanted to talk to me. And about going down there to cover the Bullets. And obviously that was not what I was. I said, thank you very, very much. But no, you know.
Right.
Celtics versus Bullets. Come on.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I don't want to. And I, you know, Baltimore. I had nothing against Baltimore. All right. I did, in fact, look, my goal in life when I was in BC, a student, was to write for Sports Illustrated. I won't deny that. And my big idol was Frank DeFord.
Well, you've written stories for Sports
Frank
Illustrated,
DeFord.
Though.
Yeah. I did one cover story, and I did a bunch of, during the years, back when they had them. They don't have them anymore. Advertising supplements.
Right.
I wrote,
well, you did the Bird Magic one.
Yes. That was my one moment
of
cover story. And and surprisingly, they didn't edit that at all. And,
really?
Yeah. I was amazed. Yeah. Totally amazed.
So DeFord contacted you by that side?
No, it wasn't DeFord. It was Mark Mulvoy.
Okay,
who
was
a BC.
Yep, went to
and
BC.
Brother of Tommy, who was then a Globe editor,
right,
and had many titles.
What year is this?
This is after my first year as well, and they, 70, and they wanted, they're talking about entry level position, and you know it wasn't.
Right.
And then there was one other brief talk about 2 years later with Mark, but it didn't really go anywhere. And I'm telling you, the last time anybody in journalism or anywhere else talked to me about going to do anything other than work for the Globe was 1976, until that day in 82 when Clark came up to talk about going to Channel 5.
I find that unbelievable.
Well, maybe they just thought I was too entrenched or
too entrenched in the Globe.
I was. Yeah. And by the way, I was. You know, I mean,
right. I understand.
Remember, I'm an out. People are often surprised, and they find out, oh, you're not from here. Well, no, I'm not. I'm from Jersey. I came up here to go to school, but I'm associated with the city. I'm proud of that.
But you are.
I'm proud of that.
But you're now from here.
Yeah, I am.
I mean,
granted,
at some point, you're from here.
Yeah, I am, and I'm proud of being associated. When people think about Boston, if ESPN, if Mike and Mike think about Boston, you know, they want to call me. I like that.
No question.
Of course. Who wouldn't?
Did you like doing the big shows back before they, you know, kicked the Globe out? Did you enjoy that experience?
Yes, I did. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, positively.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I've always loved radio. And I do, you know, right now I don't have any local. I do have one local gig. It's been going on for 33 years. Can I mention a name?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Lauren and Wally.
I remember.
On WROR. They've been 105.7 forever, and they've been through different incarnations, and now they're ROR. They were VBF, and we were KLB, and now they're ROR.
Those guys have had a hell of a run. I don't care.
Well,
you know,
it's,
I mean,
got to be unprecedented in American radio history.
Matt Siegel's almost done the same. It's insane.
But how about a partnership? How about a partnership?
How those guys get along?
Great, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any.
Must be nice.
Yeah. I've been doing them since 1983, every Thursday.
I remember driving, my dad would drive me to grammar school, and I would hear. I remember, who else used to be on there every week was Bill Fitch.
Well, that's who I succeeded him.
Really? That's who I remember first listening
to. Well, the story is that they had a person for each sport. Bill Fitch, when he left after 83, they came to me and said, would you like to, and I said, I said, sure, great. And after about 2 years, they said, you know, we'd like to, how would you feel about doing it all year? and every week, you know, and they nickname me Mr. Everything because we're on franchise. We talk about movies or whatever sometimes, whatever it is. And so I've been doing it for all those years. I was going to say, that is my only local outlet that I'm in radio now, but I have three different, you know, gigs of phone interview
Phoners,
once a week with Tony Kornheiser.
Right.
My old friend Marty Terrell, who's had countless incarnations
Both
here
around,
and in
huh?
the Midwest. He's now back in Des Moines, and I do a thing three times a week now for him. And I also write a thing for their website periodically. And the final one is one you'll be surprised, but it's been great, and I love it. And it's Primetime Sports in Toronto.
Really?
Yes. And the guy's name is Bob McCowan, and he's a very interesting kind of – he's American, but he's been up there a long time. And I love doing that show. And the cool thing about that is it's a national show. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, you know, about being heard in the Maritimes and in the Yukon Territory and in Chicoutimi and in Swift Current, home of Reggie Cleveland and wherever, or Churchill where the polar bears walk down the street, not to mention downtown Toronto. That's a fun gig. So that's my three radio things, but nothing in Boston. Other than Lauren and Wally, which is, you know, so.
What do you, this is the thing, it's sort of a constant theme on our show. I guess we talk about a lot when these situations come up. It seems to me that the younger generation, and I'll just put myself sort of, I'm 41, so I'm sort of in the edge of reason when you talk about younger generation and below, there's not a lot of voices of dissent anymore. I'm not sure where that's born from. I'm not sure why. But
really?
If I read the newspapers today or I go on Twitter with these young beat writers or these young guys, I don't know who, and just I'm just focusing on this city, really. I don't know who the next Borges is going to be. I don't know who the next Shaughnessy is going to be. I don't know that guy. And I don't always get along with those guys, obviously, but I think you need that voice of dissent all the time. You need people asking questions. Do you get that sense, too, that this
I hadn't thought about that in that context, but as you speak, I'm thinking, you know, I think Kirk's right. I can't think of who that would be, necessarily. I mean, it was never my
No, but you would not be afraid to do it if you...
No, I had to do it. No, I swung to Cleaver when I had to, but it was not my shtick, and I didn't, you know, I tried to do it judiciously, you know, and, you know, I've had a few, but that's not my...
I think contrarianism is needed. You need it somewhere.
I think that's a very good point, and I don't see it either, and neither are the two papers.
Can I give you my theory as to why? This is my theory. I think it's Twitter's a big reason why. I mean, I know I take a lot of heat on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like that, you know, some of these people take a lot of heat on Twitter, and I just don't think they want to see it. And I think if they write something negative, they're going to get bombarded. Social media, I think, has changed everything.
I don't think we have the full – you make a good point. I don't think we have a full grasp of all the ways it has changed everything. But, boy, it has. There's no question. It's
And there's some good with it too, but I think there's some bad too.
Yeah, there's some. Well, I think there's a lot of bad. And I mean, and I think it's and the teams are terrified of it. You know, whether it's colleges or pro teams, or what evil, you know, what messes, what poop can be dispensed, you know, by their players, you know, with Twitter. And there's no question how many times do people have to backtrack and apologize, and you know, we get shut. And colleges, a lot of them, you know, I don't know how many, some at least, you know, try to prevent and govern the whole year. Of Twitter,
sure.
At least during a season.
But think of it. If you're a 24, you're Bob Ryan, 24 years old, and I've worked with you a little bit. I've done some radio with you. I've done some TV with you. I'm not going to say you have a short fuse, but I don't think you like to be governed, right? I mean, I've seen, if you go and you start at the Globe right now, they're going to say, Bob, great, fantastic, here you go. Get out there. You have to tweet X amount of times a day.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do this. You have to do that. I mean, I got to think that would drive me
crazy. But that comes out of the heading of, you know, if that's all you know, you only know what you know.
No, that's true. That's
it's
true.
Like my feeling about television and the things that bug me about television that don't seem to have bugged many other people who have had long, you know, happy careers in television. If they started out there and that's the way you understand, that's the way the world is, and those are the working conditions, those are the parameters.
Yeah.
All right, fine. I'm
right.
just saying.
Right.
I'm just giving an example. It's the only one I can relate to.
Sure.
But I had a whole other way of doing things, and it was I had a hard time adjusting to the whole style of the MO of television. You know, I could do it. They were happy. I had a 2-year contract. They didn't want me to leave, but they were very gracious. They gave me because it's a great story. You know, I think you'll love this one. Okay, so I go in and I announce in December of 2003. Yeah. That I would like to leave. And they said, well, you know, we have to get a replacement first, you know. So I said, I understand that.
December of 2003?
Yeah, well, I started 83. What am I talking about? 83.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm there. I
started
in 82.
Oh, you're talking
then,
about Channel 5,
yeah.
Right.
Yes, so yeah, I yeah. walk in and I say, you know, okay, I'm not really
You're out, pleased. Right.
Okay, fine. So they said, well, you have to be wait till we get a replacement before we can let you go, because they were happy. They wouldn't be willing to let me out of the contract. And the second year. And so, okay, fine. So after a few month or so, they found a replacement. The only problem was I had to wait. He had a contract, and he was in such a contentious relationship with his employer that they weren't going to let him out 1 second early just for spite.
Really?
Keith Olbermann. Does that shock
right.
you?
He came to Channel 5,
He came
right.
to Channel 5 from CNN.
Jesus.
And it was genius.
Was O'Reilly there then?
No, I don't know where he was in, yeah. 80, in 83.
In Boston,
I don't
right.
know where O'Reilly was. He might have been here at Channel 7.
It's hard to now. Describe the people. And I'm sort of at the young – I think my generation, my age, kind of last people remember it. You can't describe to somebody who's 20, 30 years old what Lynch meant, what Lobel meant.
Oh.
Guys like Dino and Newmy and Clark Booth.
Yep.
These guys were – a guy like Lobel was an absolute giant in this.
Totally.
I don't mean to disrespect like the Joe Amorosinos and the Roaches, but they don't they just don't register anymore compared to those guys where, like you said, you got 7-8 minutes. There was no Sports Center really at that point.
Oh,
there
no.
There was no national – there was no big internet national magazines. There was no cable television really. These guys were – you would wait for these guys for stories.
Positively. It was an utterly different world. But, you know, cable
– Right, blew everything
cable,
away.
Came along big, and there were a few choices. You had, you know, the network stations were everything, and that was a very oh yeah, it was very amazing. Mike Lynch, Mike. I remember when Mike started, he was on radio WITS, which was 1510, the old WMEX, and he was playing records. At one point, I remember still hear him talking about playing Patti Page records, and then he became a weekend sportscaster.
Right.
And he worked so hard at perfecting what he was doing. And I remember I'd be there maybe on a Saturday night, and he'd do his thing, and then he'd go right into take the cassette and go in and study it and see what he did right and what he did wrong. And he took it so seriously, and it was no surprise to me that he's got to be where who he is.
The other thing that's hard to describe to people now, and you'll never see it again, I think, on a local paper scale anyway, is the influence that Will McDonough had. Mm. I mean, he was an absolute
There'll never be another Will
giant.
McDonough, and for better or worse. I used to say I barely felt I was in the same business as him. With the way he went about what he did.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, his relationships were incredible. He had no problem. He did not believe in the concept of conflict of interest. He thought that was a joke.
Right.
He did it his way, and his way, oftentimes.
How would you have handled Deflategate? My guess is now he had a good relationship with Kraft. My relationship is he'd have a good relationship with Goodell. He'd probably have a relationship with all these guys,
he
right?
Had a great, yeah, he would have had. I don't know, because right, he always had a relationship with the commissioners. God knows. That's a good question. I don't know. The Patriots. It's so interesting. He didn't live to see this whole Patriot thing become what it became.
After the first Super Bowl, right?
Yeah. Never. Yeah. I'm glad he saw that. But he cared about football so much and that league so much. There was nobody like him.
Did you like him?
Oh yeah, we were.
You got along
well. Willie. I was fine.
Would it bother you with that conflict of interest
stuff?
Would you argue about it or?
No, you couldn't. No, you kid him, and he'd laugh. It's only conflict if it conflicts with my interest. He used to say something like that. He didn't. No, he didn't. He had no conscience about it whatsoever. And that amazing story he wrote about the whole Parcells.
Incredible.
You'll never see anything like that.
Right.
Naturally, here's Parcells. He won't talk to anybody. He won't allow his assistant coaches to talk to anybody. And but he and Willie were like, Willie had the complete pipeline, total. Just went back to when he was a linebacker coach with the Patriots, and Willie befriended him.
Right.
And he never forgot it.
Would he have a good relationship with Belichick today? This Belichick?
He had it. Well, Belichick,
I know, but he's different now than he
Belichick,
was
then. Yeah, I remember Belichick. Well, Belichick, of course, yeah. I think he would have, he came to the funeral, but that was early on in his tenure. I think he felt like, everybody felt like, you got to go pay your respects, There won't be another writer laid out in the Boston, in a TD Garden in our lifetime or any others.
That's safe to say.
That's how huge Willie was. And funny thing about Willie, he didn't care about the writing.
What do you mean?
From a writing viewpoint.
From a stylist point, you mean?
Didn't care. He just banged it out. And he just wanted the story as much as anybody ever knew. He lived for the story and the scoop, and no one knew what you don't know. And he always said he was going to write a book called The Rest of the Story.
Right.
You know, and I would have liked to have read that book.
Sure.
You know, I mean, all the loose ends that he couldn't or didn't want to share at the time that he did know he was always going to, but he never did write that book. But he said he was going to.
You'll write until you're done, right?
Writing is still fun. I'd like to think that there
were... When were you, not that you're gone, but when did you officially leave?
I officially retired.
12, 13?
The London Olympics. My last official act was to write the gold medal story for the men's basketball at London.
So that's July 2012?
That was August 12th was the
date. August, okay.
I hit that send button. I had already written in advance the farewell column.
Right.
Wrote that a month earlier at the Residence Inn in Southington, Connecticut. I was down there on a Saturday night before sports reporters. Okay.
Okay.
And I was in the mood. But I finally got suddenly it all... coalesced,
something clicked, right.
Yeah, I said, okay, let's try it. Because I wanted this to be very, you know, specifically good. If I ever wrote something good, I wanted it to be this farewell column. And I wrote it there that Saturday night and tweaked it maybe very little before they finally, appeared in the paper. So it was in the paper that day, you know, that I was retiring. And, of course, I had spilled the beans much to my boss's chagrin.
Yeah, where'd you do it?
I was on a podcast with Bill Simmons.
That's right.
In February of 2012, and I basically said, yeah, this is probably going to be it after the London Olympics. And Joe Sullivan, who was not happy, you know, they wanted the, you know.
Scoop.
But he got over it. It took him about one day.
This is not what I would call.
Not that's the most earth-shaking. You know,
this is not what I would call one of the most relaxed retirements in history, though.
I'm living up to exactly what I said in it. I said, retirement is a technical term.
Mm-hmm.
It means I am no longer going to be the employee at a company for which I've worked for 44 years full-time. I'm going to be off the paywall.
Mm-hmm.
But,
so you get paid per shot now.
But yes.
Do you think you still write as well as you did 30 years ago?
Not consistently.
No,
and I said that in the piece when I retired. I could tell that I looked at some things I had done. I went, whoa, I did that. You know, I don't know if I could do that anymore. I'm amazed at some of the stuff I did.
Like what?
Be honest.
I mean, what you're talking about when? Like in the
80s? In the 80s. Particularly, I think I peaked in the 80s.
But you wrote so much.
I speculated that in the book, you know, the Bird era, Bird specifically, and the Bird teams and the NBA at the time raised my creative, fostered my creative juices more than anything that ever happened. I think I was as good as I ever was in the 80s, you know, and covering Bird.
I'm not embarrassed to admit this. There are times at night when I can't get to sleep. I will occasionally, not even occasionally, often think about those. That's the teams I grew up on, the 80s Celtics. And wrote, my dad and I, my dad split season tickets with a coworker, mm-hmm. section 114, row J, seven seats and eight, seats seven and eight. Where we sat, the big old scoreboard was there.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go under and look under and see.
Oh, yeah.
And then you had the two scoreboards, like, on the side.
On the side.
So I can only see the home on one side and the road on the other. We'd get a hot dog, and you'd see rats all the time at halftime. You'd go back. People are smoking. They'd be bitching and moaning. You go up the arena was smoky. You'd go there, and you would watch these guys. And especially a lot of the Wednesday night home games. It would dominate my day. I'd wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to see Larry Bird play basketball tonight.
Yep,
and I told
my
friends, and I'd go pretend I was Larry Bird at lunchtime.
And you know what? Those guys don't understand that. I went through this with Cowens, you know, who was my favorite personality ever. You know?
Right.
And I remember trying to explain to him, you know, he had no idea. He's not a fan. He was
not
a fan.
Well, Bird has always said.
Did not grow up as a fan.
Right. Didn't watch any games.
So he didn't understand. No, and I didn't.
The first game he ever saw was his own first NBA game. That's what he says.
Yeah, true. And, I mean, he once went to an ABA game. He was taken because he's from, you know.
India, right.
He didn't grow up that far from Louisville. You're just as well flying
right,
to go to French
South,
Lick.
Right.
You're just as well flying to Louisville as opposed to Indianapolis.
Right.
And some relative took him to a Colonels game back in the 70s, in the 60s. And he didn't even know it was a pro game. He said, "It just was a higher level of basketball."
I'm thinking, he told you this, and I'm thinking this. I read this in your book.
Yeah,
right.
So that's who he was. But he wasn't a fan. Cowens wasn't a fan, and they don't understand what you just identified. I can relate to that.
Right.
I was an Emma fan.
Right.
To me, that's my whole hook is that I'm a fan. And so many writers do everything they can to disassociate themselves from fandom. They want to set up this wall of detachment.
Including your pal Shaughnessy.
And including my pal Shaughnessy. And it works for him.
Right.
But doesn't work for me.
Right.
My whole thing is grounded in being a fan. Anyway, but what you just identified, I totally understand. Now, at some specific point, did somebody say to you, now, you know, Kirk, this is as good as it's ever going to get.
My dad grew up, you know, with Russell, good. But he would say to me, like, you have to, but that doesn't sink in. Like, I will tell, you know, there are 22 or 23 year old kids right now who all they know is that the Patriots are great. Like, they don't they don't understand. You would say to them, like, you know, my buddies and I used to drive to the stadium in high school at the game, just walk up, get tickets, sit up top, and then just move down in the second half in the pouring rain and watch Zolak, who I love, or whoever, or CQs, or these guys suck. Hugh Millen sucked year after year after year. But you could tell them that, but they don't know that. You know, I mean, I was 14. When Bert retired, I was 18. And I knew when he was gone that I'd never see somebody like him again, but you can't intellectualize that.
Yeah. But
I heard you say it the other day, and I totally agree with you. I get a kick out of Curry. I think he's great. I like Thompson. I like Kareem. I like this Golden State team. If they played the Celtics 86 team, did win the game, maybe two.
Yeah. They wouldn't be able to contend with Kevin.
Parrish,
that front line. But the game is so amazing. You realize in this All-Star game is going to be played that there are only two legitimate five men in the whole game.
Right.
Andre Drummond Jordan, and neither one and Boogie Cousins, and neither one is starting.
Right.
And that the league has finally come around to admitting the way the league is.
The ballot
doesn't even go FCG anymore.
Right.
You know, it's big and non-big or whatever they say, front court, back court, whatever.
Right.
That's where the world is now, you know.
Yeah.
But if you threw a team like the Celtics of 86 in the league today, it would so screw them
and
up.
Plus, DJ could guard. I mean, Curry would still get his moments, but DJ would give Curry a lot of problems.
He could guard. And Danny could stay with him, you know.
Right.
Danny could stay with him. So, I mean, he'd get his points. He's great. I am a member of the fan club.
Right.
The game is changing. It's so totally three-centric now. And these guys, I mean, I believe I saw a number recently the team is shooting 42% on threes.
That's
which means it's him, it's Thompson, it's Green, it's Iguodala,
Livingston,
and it's Barbosa, Livingston.
Right.
Oh, my
right.
God.
What was the process of writing the book with Bird? I imagine that...
Was to go out to French Lick for a week, and you sit there, and we basically sat in...
Where'd you stay?
At his house. I stayed in
you
the
stayed
house.
You stayed
at the house.
This is the house. This is the house.
The house with the spread, the 13 acres that you're looking at.
Is that where they actually shot the commercial with Magic Johnson?
Yeah, okay. and the outdoor court down
right.
on the block.
All real. This is
all real.
Right.
He had a pool, and he had visitors during the week. And among them, Rick Carlisle came.
Right.
Did Fernie come? No. I think maybe Eric Frenchman may have come. But he had visitors during the week.
The book came out in like 87 or 88?
Yeah. We did it in the summer of 87,
okay.
And then I wrote the book. And so I went out there for a week, and we'd sit all day, you know, and have lunch break and talk. And I had interview him, and then you the same way I did a book with Havlicek. It's where you did a book with Cousy,
right?
And it's what you do, and then you get all this stuff transcribed. My mother did it because she was a champion secretary. Otherwise, you got to get somebody to transcribe all this stuff, you know. Then you go and write the book, and you try to write the book in the voice of that person as much as you can, you know, and doing verbatim as much as you can, you know, and it's an art to it. It's not fun. It's hard. These are awfully difficult books for the writer, you know, because you want to you need to make it in the voice of that person. And we had one other little issue, which was that Bob Wolf was his agent and protector. And he was he exercised some late influence on getting some things taken out that he thought would not reflect well on Larry's image.
Is that with the daughter?
There's some other stuff
but Bird would answer everything.
Had to put
right?
up, Well, Larry went along with it. Larry went along with it. And so the book, they wanted the book that the grandmothers would like.
Right. Were you surprised if I told you in 91 or 92 that Larry Bird? 25 years, no, is that right?
Yeah,
25 years
it is
later
25
would be
years.
A, basically a lifetime NBA coach.
I wouldn't think lifetime,
office.
But I did honestly say at the time, if there's one person around who might have a chance at being the Jerry West of his era, in other words, a great player who actually might be able to, be a personnel guy, it was Larry. But the idea of the lifetime, no, I didn't think so.
Because he was smarter than everybody thought, right?
Much more. I knew this. I knew it. I used to kid that I said he had successfully evaded the American educational system, for 20 years. I mean, when you grow there, I went to French Lick enough to understand a little bit about the culture and the world he grew up in, and talking to him about what it was like to grow up, and the fatalism of growing up there, and you have your station in life. You're supposed to, not go outside of it. You don't. There's rich people. You don't have anything to do with them. You go to school, but you don't give a damn about school. You get a job. You fish and you hunt and you drink beer and you cheer for the Hoosiers. You know,
right?
And that's your life. And Larry was the education was not valued in Orange County where he grew up at all. And he wasn't stupid, but you know, he wasn't really well educated. But he was never stupid. And he saw. And once he got here, oh my God, this world opened up. He loved it here. The only thing he didn't like was traffic. Other than that, he just loved the opportunities here and loved it. And you know, he grew up in public and grew up, I thought, very well.
Does the lack of accessibility now with these guys bother you? I mean, that
totally,
was totally.
The
different.
Whole world is so different. I mean, you know. Yeah, the jokes. I mean, I told this about guys who cover today would not believe the nature of how we went about our business as opposed to how they go about their business. But one of the things that enabled me to do what I did as well as I did was the fact that I had no competition. I mean, the Herald guy, Eddie Gahuli, who was a friend of mine, you know, we got along great. And when he was out there, we did some good drinking together. But Eddie had like three jobs at the Herald. You know, he had to cover the Celtics. He had to cover. He was Mr. Z during the football season, which was a big football prognostication thing.
Right.
And he had to work the desk.
Right.
And he didn't have time to go to practice. They wouldn't let him swing him to go to practice. I was the only person at practice many, many, many times in the years 70, 71, 72.
So what's
the only person.
So a road trip to Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You'd go.
Of course you'd go.
He'd go.
First of all, yeah, well, you know.
Maybe.
You go. Yeah. No, he'd come on the road. But I mean, in terms of the daily access, I'd go.
Right.
Here's the MO. I would go. All the years they were at Hellenic College in Brooklyn. I get there about an hour before practice, maybe a little more before. I would go in the locker room and hang around. Just sit there. You know, talk to guys. Schmooze. No notebook. Just shoot the breeze, you know.
Right.
The word with the S word, you know.
Right.
And I got to know them. You know, I got to know everybody's name, the kids and the wives and the girlfriends and or the both and, you know, frankly. And and the sibs and we got. And then I'd go pop into Heinsohn's office and see what's going on, you know, anything, you know, today at practice and then watch the entire practice to the point where I got to know the entire offense. I knew the plays. When I called out the four play, I knew what the four play was. When I called out the six, I knew what the six was, et cetera, et cetera. The 15, oh my God, which was Don Nelson's bread and butter play? Yes, I did. And the 14, I mean. Then and then after practice, now I pull out the notebook. You know,
right
now I go in. Whatever the storyline I wanted to get for that off day was, you know, fine. I might even go to lunch with them. You know,
yeah.
Now a trip would mean that you congregate at the airport together. You get on the plane together. When you got to the airport, you got on the bus with them to the hotel. They always stayed at the same hotel. You got on the bus to go to the game or the shoot around if there was a shoot around
with them.
Yes, with them. And quite often you were able to get your thing done and go back with them. And I can tell you there were times when they held the bus and waited for myself. And you can ask Steve Bulpet; they'll tell you the same thing.
When did it change?
Oh, the change with.
I mean, was there a moment?
It basically started the change in the mid-'80s with two things. Charter flights, which the Pistons became the big charter flight team. To that time, only the Knicks had back in the old days, ever chartered very much.
Uh-huh.
And the Bulls. I always say the two biggest things that changed life of writers in the NBA were the charter flights, which meant you no longer travel with them, and the Bulls.
The size of Jordan, the whole thing?
The way, well, when they became a secretive KGB team,
right.
A
Gross.
Belichickian kind of team. And also they had, you know, they traveled. They built a new practice facility in which was very definitely a them and an us thing. They had a separate parking lot. You didn't even know who was there and not there. You didn't get this. And then the gradual change in not letting people come to practice for sure, and you only come in at the end and you don't really see practice. The other thing happened, as more and more people came around, they were able to control the situation about who's in the locker room, what people were hearing. People were starting to report things. When I was doing it, I had to demonstrate over a period of time that I was trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And by trustworthy, you know, that I knew when I heard stuff, what was printable and not printable, or what was printable in 6 weeks that isn't printable today, and how to protect somebody and not, you know, without attribution and all that. And now there's too many people wandering around a locker room they couldn't trust anymore, so they had to shut the locker room down.
It doesn't feel – beat writers now just don't feel – I'm trying to search for the word. It doesn't feel personalized. It's not largely not their fault. But when I read the beat writer now, whether it's at the Globe or the Herald or anywhere, you know, you feel like they are really removed from the situation.
They try to keep them as far away as possible.
Which, frankly, so, I understand from their perspective.
I mean, and I had a laugh. For me, it was just so different when a number of years ago when Brandon Jennings came in town for the first time with the Bucks, and
right.
and I wanted to do a story by talking to KG about, you know, he broke the mold. You know, he's the one
sure.
that changed everything in 95 by, you know, after that first little four-way 20 years earlier,
right.
we had Dawkins
Moses.
And we had Moses and we
right.
had Bill Willoughby, and that was
right.
it.
Right.
Ended. Boom.
Right.
Okay. Now, suddenly in 95, this kid from Chicago wants to get in the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we all know how what that triggered and how it worked out. So I wanted to talk to him about that and ask him what made him think he was, you know, could do it and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's great. The only problem, I had to go to Jeff Twist. I had to set it up. I had to have it, you know, like a formal interview set up rather than me just walking up to him
right,
like I would have walked up to Bird or McHale or Havlicek or Cowan's.
Talking for 10 minutes.
You know, I had to set it up, you know, with a big formal deal.
Right.
I just thought, and he was fine, by the way.
Yeah.
He gave me a great answer because he's very bright, and he gave me the answers, and it was a story, and I was able to do the story. It was fine. But I just thought, oh my God, how far we've come. That I got my own guy, you know, quote unquote,
right.
my own guy
right.
that I got to go through channels right. to talk with rather than just walking up to him like, you know, I'll give an example. You know, you'd hang around after practice. I'd retrieve balls, you know. I would shoot and retrieve. Kevin, one day, I was retrieving for Kevin over at Hellenic, and he says to me, I'm going to show you something. I said, what's that? So he gets the ball. He puts on a move. And he says, see that move? I said, yeah. He said, it's a great move. He says, I can't use it. I said, why? Because they'll call traveling, and it's not. And little things, moments
right,
that
right.
don't exist for yeah, any
well,
that, writer.
You'll never get that now, right?
Now.
Right.
You know, and so I keep saying, Kirk, I am so glad I did it. When I did it, and where I did it, and I mean by where I did it, I mean you know this city with the sports interest and but the readership, the people who cared. We used to get you know the feedback that we got here long before there was direct interaction.
So
with
what's your right? So what's your feedback? And let's just say you wrote something that people didn't like in '83. What was how would you get feedback? Just people write you letters?
Letters, and maybe phone call. You know, letters, phone call to the Globe, letters, and
would you write back to everybody or not?
I tried. Yeah, I mean, didn't get that many. You couldn't acknowledge. You know,
right.
I tried. Always tried. I was appreciative of it. And you know, word of yeah. I mean, it was just there was a feedback. Or you go to the Garden and people would talk to you. You know, I know the guys would come in from L.A. You can ask them. And during the great, you know, the '84-'87 run,
sure.
we were playing, and the interaction I had with people, they were surprised because nobody knew who they were in L.A. L.A.'s a company town, but that company is, you know, and we all know it's about movie industry. They didn't have that kind of interaction with fans in L.A., the beat writers for the L.A. Times and the L.A. then Herald Examiner or the other suburban papers that came in. They were just amazed at you know, the reaction that people had to me as I wandered around the Garden or around town, you know. And it was just the nature of this town.
I guess to bring it all back then, is there part of you that changed that wasn't quite the same after the whole Jamana Kid thing?
No.
Or no? Would you
no.
say you were the
I mean,
same guy?
I mean, it was just, oh, positively. It was just, you know, it was.
You were gun-shy after that? Because sometimes, I'll just.
Yeah. I was, you know, I mean, I was back. People, you know, I just had to put up a little bit of crap and just still do. Every once in a while, people, something will happen. And of course, if you go Google it, you know, you'll go Google me and you'll find.
Yeah, but if I Google your name right now, it's not the top thing.
And you'll get something on the latest one too now, you know. And
right.
You know, I'm going to have to live with that, you know. And it was stupid. And they both were, you know, well, the first one was. Anyway, it was just stupid, and both cases, Lobel on the show in question,
he gave you a raft,
gave me a chance to get right. out of it, and I didn't. I doubled up, and so did Lebatard. He gave me a chance to get out of it with Jackson, and I didn't take the advantage of the opportunity.
I know you're not going. You don't want to
talk.
I'll just say this from my own end. I think the kid thing was absurd because I know you didn't mean it, and I'm not sure you're not. Don't expect you to say anything. I'm not sure you said anything wrong about Mark Jackson. Personally, mm-hmm. We talked about it on our show. I don't think, but I understand from your spot, the way ESPN is now, you just can't do it. I mean, ESPN has changed a lot in the last 20 years.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, what hasn't? But I mean, right. But I understand that you,
but
put it this way, like I got suspended for the Aaron Andrews thing mm-hmm. a couple of summers ago. I called her a bitch, which I should not have done. A, I don't know her, so it was a stupid thing to say. And B, I knew if you walked up to me at 5:58 that morning and said, Kirk, what will happen if you say that word to describe her? I'll say, well, I'll get suspended.
Yeah, right.
It's a stupid fucking thing to say. So I knew the rules going in, and I violated them. So if that, I think that might be your argument.
Well, mine was like this, though. It's funny with this Jackson thing. I was in my living room, literally in my living room.
With Lebatard?
Yeah, on the phone.
Yeah, right.
On the phone. And now I'm going out in the afternoon. I'm getting a car, and all of a sudden I went, oh, shit. He works for ESPN.
So there was
I'm
no
done.
So there's no
trouble.
So there was no thing in your stomach when you first said it?
Nope.
Because there was for me.
I was feeling smug.
Really? Because when I did it.
I was feeling smug, and then I went.
How long did it take for it to become a thing? It didn't even really become a thing in terms of.
Well, that's the way they handled it, which was very discreet, and I was very grateful.
But there was not a big outcry against you.
Not big, no.
It wasn't on Deadspin at first. It wasn't on. It didn't get.
Eventually, got the big lead. They came around after the fact. After the suspension was over.
So they just
That's what I mean. It was a 2-week suspension.
Say it came out during a football game announcement or something.
Yeah, it was. It was the day of the AFC Championship.
Right, and they just contacted you right away and said.
They called me and said, "We're going to print a thing in an hour." I got a text. I got a text or an email. I forget.
This
which.
Is when they announced.
Email. Got an email. You're just talking about the big lead.
I'm talking about when
it was
they
done.
It was all done.
It was all done within 27 hours or 28 hours.
And you didn't fight it. You just knew.
Oh no.
Right.
I know. I didn't fight it. My God. I mean, I said, "Thank you. I appreciate it. I know I screwed up, and I won't do anything that dumb again." And thank you for and I meant it. That was no false humility.
But that's the life. That's the life of somebody who has opinions, though, and has a brain and thinks about things. Occasionally, you're going to step in shit.
But
feel bad about it.
Well, I'm angry with myself for not thinking it out. That I forgot who was back on the broadcast team at the company. You know,
right?
So,
do you think 20? 30. My son, Harry, my youngest, will be 4 years old in a couple of months. When he's 24, 34, let's say when he's 34, 30 years from now, will there be a physical Boston Globe waiting for him every Sunday?
I've been stunned.
When does it end?
I predicted this end a long time ago, that I didn't know when it was going to be 20, 30, 40, that there would be the daily print thing will be gone. There might be some national thing for, like, a la the Wall Street Journal for the real elite.
Or the Times, right.
Something like that left. But that I also thought that along the way that the mid-sized papers would be total casualties. That I predicted long ago, 15 years ago, that we, the Boston Globe, would be the last thing standing in all of New England. That in between, all the in-betweens would be gone.
You mean like the Lowell Suns?
But the town crier papers, the weeklies, might still exist because of the local news factor.
Yep, I agree.
And all your weeklies. I subscribe to the Hingham Journal. Mm-hmm. And that you need that still, and that they might survive. That was just a guess I made 15 years ago.
Right.
Philly, No, I don't think the answer is that Harry's going to be reading a paper in 2030.
Well, would you be surprised if we walked out of here today and you looked at your phone and all of a sudden there was an announcement that, just say, the Herald was – no, it wouldn't surprise me. I feel like we're at
it's amusing to me about the Herald, and I love the good – look, I'm so happy to live in a two-paper – is that they kill us, the boring broadsheet, and they love every story, and they're killing us, and they're tossing – and Howie, of course, is out there, about making fun of our finances. Who are they kidding?
Right.
Who are they kidding?
No, they're battling too, right?
Come on. We're both in this thing together in terms of surviving in a world that is going against, that is not in our way.
Doesn't feel the same, though. I'm telling you, it doesn't feel the same to look at the newspaper on the phone. It just doesn't feel the same.
No, it doesn't.
I don't think you absorb
the information. And plus, there's so many reasons why it's better. You turn the page, you see something you weren't looking for.
True.
When you go online, you're looking for, you're going online, you're reading the sports, you're not reading the rest of the paper.
Well, it's like going to a bookstore versus Amazon. Amazon, you're targeting a book.
Right.
When you go to whatever, a local bookstore
or
Barnes.
You're so right.
You stumble on something.
But that habit, the generation, and now we're in the second or even, definitely the second generation.
I'd say the second, yeah.
That doesn't have this habit and doesn't give a damn. What about what's happening with TV? Explain something to me.
Sure.
All right. I'm reading about the demise of ESPN because of the two factors. One is that they,
sling boxes.
The bundling thing, right. They got away with it, charge, and people are unbundling and all that in general terms. So I understand that.
Right.
And that's fine. But the idea that people are not taking – people, the millennials or the Gen Xs, don't watch TV at all. It's only streaming stuff that they – are you telling me that they prefer to look at something in the palm of their hand than a 72-inch screen watching the game? I don't get that.
Well, that's what I get.
Is that happening?
It is, but I don't understand.
Well, how can they
– I talk to young guys who produce –
what's the matter with them?
– who work here. And I say, you want to watch the Masters on your phone?
Yeah.
You want to watch the Final Four on your phone? But when we say that, I guess we sound like – I don't know, like my grandfather used to sound.
I know, but I mean, I don't get it.
You want
to
listen to music on this little Walkman?
You know, it's kind of funny. I was in North Carolina, but the flip side of that is just still the theory. I was in Carolina last week. I happened to be in Salisbury, North Carolina. And so, you know, it was Panthers country. And I heard several ads for people, you know, advertising, you know, but the big game on Sunday, you know, you need a good TV, you know,
right.
You know, trying to go out and, you know, buy that 72-incher, you know. So they were appealing to that crowd that still wants to do it.
It's changed. It's totally changed.
I know. And, you know, you don't want to sound old. I've tried not to be, I have enough opinions that go against the grain in sports, but I hope I don't. One thing that I'd like to emphasize, though, I love the turnover of people, you know, the turnover of talent. I still look forward to seeing the next big thing, you know. I appreciate a Curry special. We've never seen anything quite like Curry. We've never seen a guy that could shoot from that distance and get his own shot. Ray Allen could shoot from the distance. Couldn't get his own shot the way that he needed to pick.
He's the
come
best
up
shooter I've ever seen. It pains me to say
it's a combination of Ray Allen and I'm going to say Iverson. Iverson could always get his own shot from 15.
Right.
You know, but that crossover.
But he would shoot 42-41%.
Yeah. I mean, but this guy's.
But I'll tell you, another guy is, you know, if Mike Trout stays healthy.
Oh.
If he retires, he's 38, 39, he's going to hit 600 home runs. He's going to win 6 or 7 MVPs. I mean, you're right. In each of these sports, you want to appreciate Russell Wilson. You want to appreciate these guys.
Yeah.
But
I don't. Or Cam. Cam had a bad day. Well, I'm already thinking about, oh, boy, you know, dying to see how he comes out back from this, you know, what he does next year, you know.
Right.
I'm sure he'll be fine. I think, you know, on the field.
So you're sticking around. We're going to read you once a week for a while.
30 to 40, which is 2 or 3 a month.
So that's not going the way.
No. Not as long as Joe Sullivan, sports editor. I'm safe.
We're going to see you on TV all the time.
As long as, at least for another year, because now we're on a contract situation at ESPN. That just started 2 years ago. So I have one. I'm all set for this year. And I'm thinking about them year to year, because I'm not sure, you know, they laid off 300 people, as you know. They let some big price people go.
Right.
I don't know where they're going, when they're going to decide, do we need these people, you know. Plus, I'm getting up there, you know. I mean, I've already challenging the age demographic thing, you know. So I'm not certain about them, but I'm fine there. Comcast and I are fine. My radio.
Wish I could say the same.
So, you know. So
you know what you like? You know what? I just see this with you, though. You said you like being in the newsroom. I haven't seen you do that, but I see you at Comcast. You like being in the middle of the action still.
It's like when I was at school, Kirk. I was one of these guys that I couldn't imagine not living in the dorm.
Right.
The last thing in the world I want to do is live in an apartment off campus.
Right, right.
Last thing in the world. I wanted to be able to walk out the door and walk down a corridor and get a conversation.
But you like being a character in the play.
Get a conversation.
Yes.
That was the way. To me, that was what school was, not living in an apartment
and
having to do your own laundry and worrying about food. And not to mention, it's just a socialization factor. I loved it. And I loved the office for the same reason. I like being part of that group, you know.
Feel when you walk in the Globe now that you're – sort of, you know.
They're used to seeing me come in. I mean,
you start looking at these people and saying, geez, these people are 50 years younger.
Years.
I mean, does that bother you feel?
No. I've never been an ageist, a worried guy about any of that. I accept that as part of the deal, and it's that's always been fine, you know. And so, you know, I get a guy like Chris Gasper, who basically I would say succeeded me, you know, and I'm really happy that he's the one. And he's, you know, but he's got an old soul, though. He really does. And that's, you know, I like that. But no, the answer is no. I've never been hung up on all that stuff. That's never the way I've been.
All right. Well, Bob, I appreciate the time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We'll do this again. I'll drag you in here again at some point. Say hello to Wally for me.
I shall. All right, Kirk.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.